Right. So the locals will go down. Yeah.
Rabbi Bender,
you can take tea. Rabbi Bender, can you take tea? No,
What I started to say in the middle over here was to emphasize the fact what happened was, it just occurred to me a few things that were bothering me as I was falling asleep last night. I mean, I thought about it before. I'm just trying to come up with a better solution to the problem was just to highlight the fact that Yaakov was unprepared for the things he said in the brachos when he gave the brachos to his sons. In the middle, we have that pasuk. Suddenly, it's not so much that he has an epiphany, to use that word, but he's talking, and he realizes, when does he really realize that he's saying things that he never intended to say? Because as he's talking to them, the pasuk, l'shivoscha kivisi Hashem, seems to be totally out of place. I mean, what does that mean? In the middle, he's talking to Don, and what is that all about? How does that come out? It doesn't...
Rashi says,
we know what it means, but what's that got to do with anything? I mean, it just doesn't seem, because all the brachas are to each person. Do you think when he's standing there, Don is standing in front of him, and he's talking to Don, that all of a sudden he says, he's talking, and he says, L'shuascha kivisi Hashem. You think maybe Don's reaction is, what does that mean? What are you saying? Don didn't understand it, certainly. Why would Don understand that? He's saying, but I think part of that is he just, thoughts are coming into his head, and he's not in control of the words coming out of his mouth. Or he's seeing things that it's like all of a sudden is like sometimes, you're speaking and you realize something. The thing that I remember in particular when I was making this, you're saying something that the Abarbanel said when God said to Avraham, Lech lecha me'atzecha me'latetecha me'beis avicha, and the Abarbanel says, why didn't God tell him where he was going? What was the point? Doesn't say. El Oretz Asher Arecha. So he says, what's the point? I don't have to tell you where you're going. You're a Jew. They don't like you. They threw you in the Kivshon Aish. It's time to get out of here. Does it matter where you're going? Here, you don't want to be. And as I was speaking, I realized he's talking about himself. And I interrupted myself while I was speaking. I said, I just realized, I'm quoting Abarbanel. This was a personal experience to him. He says it in his own introduction when he says, when he writes a lot of things on the side, the introduction, he said he made a big mistake in his life. He never thought for one minute that even with the process of the expulsion going on, that they were never going to kick him out. I mean, he was above it all. He was too important. The end result was, I was just another Jew. And they kicked me out too. And I made a terrible mistake. I put my eggs in the wrong basket. And he's saying to people that never get comfortable with being a Jew. You know, the idea is that you're just, and this is what I've told many people who want to blend in and just, they don't want to, I don't mean to just not wear their religion on the sleeve, but in general, that, I tell sometimes when I'm talking to a non-from person, and I say to him, I said, listen, when it all comes down to it, it didn't make a difference if you were you never went to shul, even on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, you don't go to shul and you weren't a Jew, Hitler still came after you. It didn't make a difference if you just said, I renounce Judaism, and I'm going to be a Shegetz, I don't care. They still put you in the gas chamber. It didn't matter. So why go through all this aggravation and have this guilt conscience? Because a lot of these people have guilt consciences. I was reading on the origin of, they did a show on Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, but Louis B. Mayer, when his mother was the businessman in the family, so to speak, and in Europe they manufactured leather gloves. And where he made his big money was, for World War I, his parents in America, or his mother, had a glove factory, and they got the contract to make gloves for all the soldiers in World War I. And that's where the family amassed their money, and his name was Gelbfish. That was his name. And it became from Gelbfish it became Goldfish, Goldwyn, and then Selwyn when they split. And because the Sel, he combined names and so on. And he totally was like a non-Jew, tried to hide his Judaism and not be a Jew and let it be. But somewhere along the line during World War II, it broke him. When he realized what was going on, the whole Meisel with the concentration camp, he just came out and started to be a very open Jew with giving money and making movies that were anti-Nazi and giving, giving to Jewish organizations and wearing his, so to speak, Judaism on his sleeve, because eventually he couldn't take it anymore. He realized that they're coming for me eventually. I'm being a fool. And those were the things that he said. I'm being a closet Jew, and I'm trying to, be a Shegetz. It's not working. Obviously, it never makes a difference. But here, what I started to say was that it says, suddenly, he's in the middle of talking, and he says, whatever God put thoughts in his mind, we say that he lost his nevuah, but he lost maybe the dating period for when the Gula would come. But it's just that suddenly he says, L'shuasho kivisi Hashem. God is letting him see the future, and he sees what Rashi says. Perhaps that's what it is. We don't know. But the thing is, as I was just mentioning, that's one pasuk. We say it, Kriya Shma Lamita, and you say, L'shuvascha kivisi Hashem, Hashem l'shuvascha kivisi, kivisi Hashem l'shuvascha. You say it all different ways. Could you give me another pasuk that means the same thing no matter how you phrase it? It's a very interesting pasuk. L'shuvascha, to your salvation. Salvation we hope for. God, we hope for your salvation. No matter how you say you translate the words, the meaning comes out the same. What? Yeah, but in other words, no matter how you say, no matter what order you put the words, it's still, the meaning is exactly the same. You can't translate it any other way. So the reason I mentioned that also, I once mentioned before, at the end of, I don't know why I keep forgetting it, but it's the last marsha in either Makos or Moikot, and I think it's Makos, when he says, he tells us about the pasuk, when it says, we say it in davening in the morning in Hodu, but he uses the word Lishuascha. You're looking for salvation and you don't know where it comes from, and you assume whatever it is, I had good luck, I bought a lottery ticket, it happened this way. The point is, he's saying the pasuk that we say in davening, this is it. I don't know why I went blank on the pasuk. It's part of Atoresa, but this is another way to express it. Vani b'chazer b'tachti ogeli b'bishua secha. That's not the pasuk I'm looking for, but in other words, b'shua secha is highlighting on the fact b'shua secha. What you're trying to achieve is, if somebody else comes along and help you, you feel good. But what would be the best feeling in the world possible? Why do we say l'shuascha? Because very simply, if somebody comes along and help you, so you feel good, you have a nice friend. But how much greater is it to know, if you really understand, that you know who came to my aid? It was God himself took the time out to help me out. Doesn't that make you feel even better? If you could really pinpoint and say, this was 100% the hand of God, I don't think you could have a better feeling if you could really know it. So what we want to achieve in our own life is, you know, we want good fortune, but we also would like to be able to know that it was God, so Lishua Scha Kivisi Hashem. I'm not hoping that Vizkartani El Paro Votzisani Minabayas Azer, that God, you know, that the Saramashka was, you know, reminded that this Narev Ivri is in the bar and he wants my dream. And it's Lishua Scha Kivisi Hashem. It's his salvation that makes me feel good. And that's the point that he's trying to say over here. The interesting thing is that I once mentioned, I remember when I said it in an offer for my last son, but the point is that when it says Hikavtsu v'shimu, especially at the beginning, when it says Ruvein b'choriato, kochi v'reishis oni, and he goes on and then he says Shimon v'levi achim, which is another thing, why does it say particularly Shimon v'levi achim? Ruvein, what, they're all brothers. Why Shimon v'Levi Achim? He says, because they were exactly alike. You two, everybody knows, are brothers. You think alike, you act alike. The difference between them at the end was, look what happened to Shevet Shimon in the Midbar. Look what happened to Levi. They became, they achal came be Yaakov, afitzem be Yisrael. They both were, even Shimon got a little land. Levi was not given land, but not because of this, but he wasn't given any land. The point is, Levi learned his lesson and channeled his anger towards the right, in the right direction. So what I wanted to suggest, other than this, just while I'm saying it, is that when it says, Achal kein bi Yaakov, afitzem bi Yisrael, Shimon and Levi were the ones who were always carrying the physical ball, so to speak, for Klal Yisrael. Even though Yehuda certainly had the Gevura, but he wasn't the first one to act. Yehuda had to act because of things that Shimon HaLevi did. They, Klei Chamos Mecheiro Sehem, which is another thing that he mentions over here, by the way. Klei Chamos Mecheiro Sehem, what is that all about? Klei Chamos, what did they ever do that was Klei Chamos Mecheiro Sehem? They were thieves? Well, yeah. He said, because what was their intention of rescuing Dina? Their intention of rescuing Dina was, seemingly on the surface, to rescue Dina. That was all it is. But instead of rescuing Dina, they didn't just go after Shechem. He deserved to die. And certainly they could have, you know, had to fight through. Actually, he mentions over here, the Abarbanel, that, you know, the palace has palace guards, so you're going to get into a battle with the Shechem's, has his retinue of people who are taking care, so they have to kill people to get to him. But if they're all Biosom Koavim, they are. So he says he shouldn't have necessarily, what Yaakov is saying is, Shechem had he had a right to kill him, but you didn't have a right to kill all the other people. You could have, whatever you did. If they were the Bris Milah, they weren't the ones who were complicit. They had the wrong intention, certainly, for doing the Bris Milah, because when Osana was Chem, and, you know, we're going to intermarry, we're going to get all their wealth, how whatever it is, but they didn't deserve Misa, maybe. Not everybody agrees that they didn't deserve Misa, certainly, but the fact is they didn't deserve Misa, Yaakov is telling them. And not only that, but what happened when it was over? They brought back the spoils of war. That's what he's saying. Kalei chamos mechero sehem. So you're trying to tell me you did it. Hachzono yaseh sachosenu. Sounds good. So then why are you bringing home all the goodies that you took from them? So vayitmono sam tachasoy lo. I got to teach them a lesson. The spoils of war weren't part of the equation here. You had, seemingly, you were thinking properly on some level, but the end result was kalei chamos mecheiro sehem. The end result was you got caught up, and you said, as long as we're doing it, we'll do this. So You're not tzaddikim. Don't think that what you did, and so what does it mean, Vayomru hachzono yasachoseinu? That's just, if that's your attitude, at that point in time, I have nothing to say. But when I say something, as he mentions early on, why did he get them together now? When somebody is talking on his deathbed, you take it more seriously. At this point in time, when it's just like Moshe Rabbeinu at the end, Rabbi Albert makes an interesting point. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't wax poetic about all the good things to Klal Yisrael. He says, what's the extra vav on it? The parsha should have begin Zos HaBracha. What do you mean Vizos HaBracha? Very simply is, he was the whole Sefer Devarim, he's giving them tochacha, one sedra worse than the next, interspersing a lot of halachas that we hadn't had before, repeating certain things, giving us more information. But the first three parshas in the, you know, Devarim Ekev, in Voskanon, there's just he sold it upon him, and one thing worse than the next, telling him all these terrible things, and he says, all right, you know what? Everybody gather around and listen. But Zos HaBracha, this is, I'm giving you, this is a one-shot deal. I'll give you the good news right before I die. I'm going to give you the good news that this is the bracha that you have. Listen. So Yaakov wants to tell them everything now. But what is interesting is that if I'm going to talk to Reuven, Shimon, and Levi this way, you call each one in yeshiva. You don't see most of the time, if the Rosh Hashiva wants to take a boy and give, you know, tell him you're not doing what I expect you to do, call him into the office. The Rebbe would tap you on the shoulder. Unfortunately, you know, I had the experience that I'm not up to par. And talk to me privately, not give me a tongue lashing in front of the whole class. But you get Rebbes who do that. But just say, I want to talk to you. I told you that one time when I, you know, when he came over to me and he says, oh, I didn't see a yarmulke. Oh, you do have a yarmulke on. Okay, good. The next day when I was sitting there, he went, I want to talk to you. He said, I see what I said to you yesterday. You didn't understand. Of course I knew you were wearing a yarmulke. I was trying to tell you it's too small. That it was harder to see.
But it's a story.
Yeah. Well, it's a story, right? But that was something else. I was crossing the street. Yeah, I was coming out of a restaurant. And no, because something else that reminded me that happened that time that I saw somebody. But anyhow, as I'm crossing the street, a guy, Lubavitcher guy's, you know, starting with, you put on film today, okay, like that. And he's rubbing me on the back. And he's rubbing me on the back, and I'm laughing. And my wife said, we weren't married yet. And I'm laughing. And Rivki says to me, why are you laughing? I said, he's feeling for my tzitzis. I said, but I'm wearing it. And as soon as he felt the little extra bump in my under my shirt, he walked away and said, okay, he's wearing tzitzis too. You know, must be okay.
As long as he doesn't check for your brisk meal.
Right, yeah. This is, you see, you trigger what I appreciate. What I appreciate with these things is everything when I'm teaching Sunday morning in Blat Gemara, I say, whatever you want to say, I'm telling you now, don't be ashamed to say it. Everything you're thinking is in play. I'm giving you information to make you say something. I'm trying. Now I know you're listening. When I hear a reaction a lot of times, I know you're paying attention because you're saying something that's important. And why does that ring a bell with what you said today? Because of the parsha. Simno yotcha tachas yirechi. Right? So, what was that? But he says, to carry me, is what does it mean to carry me? The symbolism wasn't that it was bris milah and the only mitzvah that they had to swear by. When you, because it happened to me in my life, you know, you play a ball, but he stick your hand under me. It's like you're carrying me. That if you would want to lift somebody up, you would have to stick your hand between his legs, put one hand over the shoulder, put one hand up between his legs, and lift him off the ground. You're going to carry me to Eretz Yisrael. I need you to carry me to Eretz Yisrael. Take me. That's how the symbolism is to carry me. But what is your siso imodi? I thank you because you say something that triggers a memory of something that I read yesterday. What is the thought process of your siso imodi chesed ve'emes? Just tell me. I'm your father, and I'm telling you to swear to me. I want to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. He has to say to Yosef, V'yosiso imodi chesed ve'emes. He's saying to Yosef, he makes an interesting point, and he says, I want to tell you, you know what? I need you to take me to Eretz Yisrael. Because it's not my fault I'm here. You know why I ended up coming down to Mitzrayim? Because of you. You're the cause why I'm here in the first place. Because you are in Mitzrayim. I came down to see you. I wouldn't be here. It's your fault. So now, the only reason I'm here and is because of you. So it's your responsibility now to take me back where I came from. I left Hebron, and now I need you to take me back to Hebron. Because I only came down here because of you. So I need you to put your hand between my legs and lift me up and carry me to Eretz Yisrael. And that's what it says, V'yasisi modi chesed v'emes al nosik bereini. Because I only came because of you. Just interesting thought.
Yaakov Avinu learned from Avraham Avinu that Vayashva et Eliezer not to take.
That's Yitzchak. That's
Avraham also did.
Yeah. Fine, but that we say everybody says that was because he only had that mitzvah to do. That was something else completely.
They have more mitzvah in that time.
Yeah, so that's Yaakov. I mean, we know that's what we got. I'm just saying the Avraham Avinu wants to put an extra symbolism to the act. That's what he's saying over here. At this point in time, there might have been other thoughts on his mind. He's like, this is speculation. We all get Shiva Panim L'Torah. You get the, you know, you get to say, but that's what I'm saying. He's thinking outside the box. Think outside the box. You're everything, in other words, when you say something, you're quoting. When you say a pshat on a pasuk, is it your own thoughts? Or are you just repeating what you read?
Repeating.
Exactly. Who cares? We all know it. My point is, I'm not trying to belittle, but the point is, we read the Ramban, we read the Radak, we read it all, so we know what it says. What do we want to do? What makes interesting discussion is, how does your mind work? I want to hear what you say. I want to hear what somebody else says. That makes life interesting, and it makes it more poignant to you personally. When you have your own thought, you think, when I learn a piece of Gemara, and I understand, and it mentions a pasuk in davening, and it explains to me what the pasuk means, when I'm davening the next time, from that day for the rest of my life, when I'm learning, when I'm davening, I think about what the pshat on that pasuk is. When it says, you know, mishpatim, but you know, lo asa chen l'chol goy, you know what the Gemara says on the Pasuk, and when you're saying the Yom, and you're saying, you know, Eidus B'Yosef, some over says me Eretz Mitzrayim, it's talking about Yosef being Mitzrayim. All these psukim, they teach you exactly what to think when you're saying it, you know, Perish HaMilos. That's what Perish HaMilos means. Not just translation of the word. What was on the minds of the people who wrote Tefillah? And that's very important. And it really... But it means something to you. That's what davening with kavana is, saying what the Gemara tells you, a lot of the tefillos, and it starts to say, quote a pasuk, and then it explains, this is what we had in mind when we wrote the pasuk. Learning tilim tells you all about knowing what the Perish HaMilos are. You're saying so much of tilim in the morning. If you learn tilim, and you read the psukim, and read what the Perish is, it's not just to translate the words into English. It's translating the words. What was David HaMelech thinking when he wrote this pasuk? And it gives you an insight to a certain level of feeling about what you're saying. And that's a good way to look at things. So what I started to say is that it's hard to remember sometimes when I start to digress. But I started to say, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, talk to them privately. But he gets everybody together and he starts to give one brother after the other a tongue lashing, And then he says, this is this, and this is this. And that's what the message is. He kapsu v'shimu b'nei Yaakov v'shimu al. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen at the end of days is, I need everyone together. Because each, no man is an island unto himself. Even though each one of you is your own shevet, and it will grow and grow and grow. But the truth of the matter is, everybody, the survival of Judaism depends on, as I started the day beginning with unity. What do I mean by unity? Understand, we all can't think alike exactly, obviously. Everybody is a different person. No two people think exactly alike. The problem is, everybody has his pluses and minuses. And I need you to understand that you are together. Shimon Belevi, even due to your brothers, but what Shimon lacks, Levi, you could pick up the slack. Yisachar and Zvulun. What Yisachar lacks, Zvulun will pay for. What Zvulun lacks, Yisachar will pick up the slack. All of you together make one unit. You are not separate, no matter how much you can achieve. The sum is greater than the parts. And each person is not his own person, but you achieve the Gula Shlema when you all realize when somebody else is suffering, if you have the ability to make him a more complete person, that's your duty, that's your achrayas. When you're suffering, that person has to come to your... You could have a lot of, you know, you could be very rich, but you don't have your health. One person has his health, he has no money. But as a team, you both, you know, I could pay for the doctor, I could pay for the operation, and, you know, whatever it is. However it achieves together. But I need you all in one room to understand that. If I talk to each one of you separately, it remains each one in his mind, and you walk away thinking whatever you're thinking. But I need you to understand that. Hikavtsu v'shimu, the Lashon of the Gemara, the Lashon of the Chumash, is very pointed. V'shimu al Yisrael avichem, I'm your father. It's not v'shimu. What is he, like I said yesterday, keeps on saying again, Shimu al Yisrael avichem. And so what I mentioned previously really comes into play here. Yaakov, he's telling what I learned in my life. The word Yaakov is, the connotation is past experience that gives me the point of the future of Klal Yisrael, Vishumu El Yisrael Avichem. Your father is thinking about how Yisrael will survive. Yaakov is telling you what brings me to this point. My life experience teaches me this much, and now I'm telling you how Yisrael will survive. Because my survival, which I certainly want, is dependent on your ability to achieve what I set out for you the way I brought you up. And if you will do that, the Gula will come. And Lishuascha Kivisi Hashem, and he sees it himself. All right, I think I've exhausted all the things that I could just think of off the cuff on the Parsha. So what I got over here is, so yesterday I started to say about,
what? You say that why Yaakov Avinu advised all of them together. Yeah. Maybe he wanted to tell them if someone is going to do the same mistake that Reuven did, you should not do. The acts.
Fine.
And it is not publicly, it is, everybody knows that Shimon and Levi, they killed all of the Shechem.
Right.
They did know everything. Reuben that, Vayishkav et Bilon Eshet Avi, they did know that he did something wrong with Yaakov and it made him upset.
The Perushim that say that all the people of Shechem deserve to die was based on one simple thing. The whole time that they're negotiating and seem like they're talking and they say it, where was Dina? They were still holding her hostage. She's still being held hostage. You know, we forget, sometimes we look over that point. And you're saying to me, you know, we'll have a bris milah and we'll get together. It seems like there's a very friendly discussion. So send Dina home in the meantime. Or let her leave, you know, if she wants to stay, but let her go. But in the meantime, where is Dina? They took Dina. She's still being held hostage. So this is where everybody was complicit. Why didn't they go to Shechem and say, yeah, we understand that we're doing it, but it's a show of good faith, let her go. You're not letting her go. Oh, that's why you have her. Now that's the rationale for killing everybody. I forgot whose opinion that is, probably Abarbanel, but I think the Malbim says it. This sounds like very old in my mind before I got a hold of the Abarbanel, but I think the Malbim makes a point of saying that. And I think the Gemara talks about that. That the whole time is that they're still, I think it's the Gemara, that they're still being held hostage at the time, so they all deserve the death penalty. One of the things about visiting the person is, he asked the question over here. So we said, Mr. Rapport mentioned yesterday, aren't you supposed to daven with the person when you come to visit? So of course you're supposed to daven. The question becomes, let's say, and I remember one time when I went to visit one of my father's sisters, my wife wanted to come with me, and you know, and she was, nevertheless, she had late stages already, and she was in her 80s, and she was suffering. And my wife didn't appreciate what she, when I knew her, you know, much longer than my wife did, and my wife leaned over to her, and she couldn't talk very loud, she was laying in her bed, and she says to my wife, my wife says to her, Auntie Annie, what can I get you something? What could I do for you? What could I get you? And my aunt looks at her, and I overheard, and she says, an exit. And my wife looked at me, and she said, did she want me to leave the room? I don't know. I said, no, she wants to die. And so my wife said, no, that kid. I said, yeah, that's what she's saying. She wants an exit. What does it mean, she wants an exit? She's had enough. So the question is over here, when one davens for the health of a parent or a Rebbe, he should not, it says, all right, it says, should not honor them with any ties or descriptions. He should simply say, my father Ploni or my Rebbe Ploni. My grandfather had said, one of my grandfathers, he said that time when they put up his matzeva, and he wasn't sick, he died suddenly and without any warning. He left one of his savors that he wrote down is that his honors matseva, I don't want any titles. Because the way he said, my mother repeated, I was young when he died, but he said to my mother, Benech Ligen Dred Benech Gunish. So he said, I'm just Aryeroth. Mr. Aryeroth, that's all. Don't put titles on my on the grave. Because who cares? What's the difference? Whatever it is, God knows. You know, titles mean nothing at this point in time. And that's the point is, this is really what a Malbim says on Vayatsev Yaakov Matzevoal Kurosa. It says, He Matzevis Kuras Rachel Arayom. What it says on the gravestone doesn't mean anything. It's a marker. A Matzev is a marker. That's it. You're supposed to put a tzion on a grave. What's the point? There's a grave here. You should know. If there's a Kohen marching on the road, or you're going to bring a carbon, you don't want to be tummy, you don't want to pass over a karka, you know, you have to put up a marker so you know where graves are. That's all. It's a marker. You don't have to have speeches on there. You don't have to wax poetic on the thing, because you know what the marker, you know what the leftover is? The children you leave behind. The children you leave behind, they are your... That's your tzion. That is what you're leaving behind. You leave behind children who are shomer Torah mitzvos. You leave behind children who do chasadim, who give tzedakah, who benefit society, who are citizens, good citizens of the world. That's your marker. That's what you're leaving behind. So it says when one davens for the health, somebody, like my aunt, it says, when davening for a sick person, one should daven only in Lashon HaKodesh, interestingly enough. If he davens in the presence of the patient, he may daven in any language in the presence of the person, so he could say. By the way, as opposed to seemingly what I read, I don't know if you do it, but if a person's in shul, you're not supposed to make a mishaber for a chayla when the person is in shul at the time, so to speak. I don't know if it's because you don't want to scare him, or if he was able to make it to shul, then maybe, I don't know.
Right.
It's befana, right. But is it best if the sick person could, it says, it is best if the sick person could daven for himself. That's where we left off yesterday. But this is the interesting thing. There is a dispute among the poskim concerning whether one is allowed to daven for the death of a patient. Somebody is suffering, and he really has had it. It's over. He doesn't want to go on. So if now that you know what he wants. In other words, what is the whole thing? It says in the Yotzah, Dinam and Menahagim, it talks about why for Shimon Ben Yochai, it's the Yom Hilula. Shimon Ben Yochai, it's his yard site. Whose yard site do we make a party? Why do we make a party for Shimon Ben Yochai? Because he got what he wanted.
Moshe didn't want to die.
He didn't want to die. It's a yard site. The person didn't want to leave this world. Shimon Ben Yochai said, take me now. I can't live here anymore. And he got what he wanted. He prayed to leave this world, and he got just what he wanted. It was the happiest day of his life. He left. And that's it. So it's a party. He got what he wanted. So now,
if someone dying for a sick person,
yeah,
he should get killed not if no law or killed not if no law.
You want to say those words in particular? Who says those words in particular? No, I know Moshe Rabbeinu said about Miriam, Kel no refa no la.
For the sake, we can't say Kel no refa no lo, Kel no refa no la.
He didn't pray for Aaron, did he? How come he didn't pray for Aaron?
What?
How come he didn't
Aaron
pray for
sick.
Aaron?
Aaron wasn't sick.
No, he got Saras.
But he was not a mukhlat.
No, he wasn't. Why not?
Why wasn't
he? Why not?
He already suffered the loss of his two children. He already got the ultimate.
How many kahanim were there then? In other words, one of the things that I read in the sefer, this is not a Barbanel, this is not Malbim, this is just a very, you know, in the Pnina Kedem, I don't even remember who said it. But it's a numbers game. We add over here why, so we know that our own, what was the reason that he died, besides Vehikru Vameh Zorah, but from the Egel. Yeah. So Elazar and Yisrael, we have all these various reasons. Elazar and his son survived. Moshe Rabbeinu was able to intercede on their behalf. That's the Baba Basra. Or very simply, that one of the Mefarshim say that he prayed that why should their family suffer because of what Aaron did, their wives and children. He said, yeah, but Nadav and Avihu are single. They have nobody depending on them. They weren't married. So they're going to go. Some were married people with their own children, so it's true they shouldn't die. But it was a numbers game. So what are they going to do when they have to bring the carbon, when they Chanukah, Samiz Beach, when they have the Mishkan, all the carbonus, when he left at the hands of Aaron, it's just impossible. You need it, Elazar and Isamar. He needed a couple of people. There were only three Kohanim left. If he would take away Elazar and Isamar too, it would leave Aaron as the last man standing. And that wasn't going to work. It was, God said, oh, listen, you know, I'm looking for the best scenario over here. I'm going to leave you a couple of people who, you know, Pinchas wasn't a Kohen yet. Pinchas wasn't designated yet till Parshas Pinchas. So that was the scenario. What else are you going to do? So it was a numbers game. That's one shot. I mean, I read that in a sefer. So it says there is whether you can, one is allowed to help, you know, are you allowed to, you know, pray for the death of a patient who is suffering terribly and has no chance of recovery?
So who's possible? Who's that?
Yeah, so he says, in other words, he doesn't give you his opinion. He says, many allow it and some death? Do not. Yeah, to pray for somebody
death.
To get, yes.
Is there a principle I want to
so think? He, yeah, go ahead.
A person who's terminally ill and suffering, you mispalo that their pain should come to an end. You don't pray directly they should die.
Right.
And you don't pray they should get better because it's not possible.
Right. It's not happening.
You just pray that their pain should come to an end. And that can be interpreted by Hashem to mean to die. Okay, so be it. But you're not explicitly demanding or requesting death.
I understand. So what he says over here is, for those who say many allow it, he quotes here, it's the Pharisee Israel in Yuma, and also it says the Orach HaShulchan Yeridea, 335.3, Igris Moshe, Koshen Mishpat, 273, and the Sh'arim HaMetzuyonim Bahalacha, 194-2. Their view is based on the run in the Dharm on Mem Amid Aleph, he says.
What's that now?
I don't know. I didn't look it up.
The executioner asked him, can I...
Oh, that one. Okay, that's what it is in the Dharm. I wasn't aware.
That's my cousin. But he told him, he gave him a shus to accelerate his death.
Death, right.
So you see that
okay.
Acceleration.
Right. And those against it, and while others do not, he quotes the Tzitz Eliezer in Ramas Rachel, Mishnah 5, who rules that this situation, one should not daven either way. Don't say anything. Silence is golden.
We should use the expression, Hashem should have rachamim.
Right, this is what Rabbi Levine just said, basically.
That
just say to relieve the pain. That's what it's saying. Have rachamim on the person. Don't make him suffer.
The pain should come to an end.
End, right. So however that's achieved.
Don't directly demand that
correct.
Correct. First, what is chayei shoh?
Right.
When Chazal say, yofesh shoh achas boilam hazeh, does that mean wildly chayei shoh? Or does that mean hooked up to every machine in the world? Totally unconscious. Who says it mean? That means chai chai shah means a moment of consciousness. So yof chai shah, 1 second of consciousness is kedai. But a person on a machine and he's finished, what you're going to say that's chai shah?
Yeah, how do you know that?
We don't know that's bad.
Right.
It's mechapers of
you don't know.
We don't know.
You don't know.
Who
but
says
you say tzaddikim, why do they suffer? Because
it's the suffering. When they're on morphine and they're completely hooked up, is that called chayei shoh?
Absolutely not.
We don't know that.
Well, yeah, the paisik a lot of times.
The paisik can only do it individually.
Chassid shoy woman means, you know, I was in the hospital once, and they, boy, did they give them a hard time. DNR, and we're going to keep this corpse alive.
Yeah.
Forever. And the whole hospital staff is just like,
well, the last day of my father's life, I didn't make the call, but my brother-in-law called Reb David, Rabbi Feinstein, and asked him, should we attempt to keep him alive at this point? And he asked, the question that he asked him was, when the doctor says he's going to do this procedure, how much longer will it increase his life? And so he asked the doctor, he said, maybe a couple of days at best. Maybe. I don't know. He said, you're not mechuyev to do it. It's over. It's over. There's no chance of, you know, he had been, you know, sepsis had already begun and various things, and he knew it. And we. So I said to my father, he laughed and he looked at me with a smile and he said, is this really necessary? You know, he would like looked at me and he smiled and he said, it's over. You know, he said to me, I mean, I remember the words. He said, I had a good run. That's it. Those are the words he said.
The thing to one of the Gedolim that he was diagnosed with something that was, at that time, 100% terminal. And they say, you know, we can do treatment. So the Gedolim said to his son, I don't want to do this under no condition to torture me. I'm not a chuyiv to. However, your mother will live with guilt
right.
for the rest of her life that it was something else they could have done that maybe would have worked.
My mother felt that way for a long time. She didn't understand. The doctors weren't honest with her about, we told her later what the doctors had said. She thought that he had a lot more time left. Of course, that was the impression she got. My father knew better, but didn't clue her in. And the doctors didn't tell anybody, but the doctors told us later, you know, and said it was a lost cause right from the get-go. Of course, you know. But it basically, they were trying to make her feel better, and that's it. She said they lied to her. They told her he would live a lot longer, you know, but whatever. But anyhow, so you have, it says, many of us, some who do not, and he quotes who obviously do not. What?
Are you allowed to say to a patient, let's say you go to a rough, you're rough.
Yeah.
And you tell
nice
the person.
Nice to know.
You tell the person, you know the statistics. You know what he has.
Right.
It's a goner. Are you allowed to say then, it's going to be okay? Don't worry, you're going to be okay. Are you allowed to say that?
Well, in medical journal, I've read a few medical journals that sometimes very important to let the person know where he's up to, so he could either on one level put his mind at ease and tell people things that are important for them to know, and otherwise if they have these unexpected expectations that maybe there will be, maybe that you're not doing a chesed to him also, because he has last words to say to people that are very important. I don't know. I mean, it's a difference of opinion. You probably see it a lot more, but
most of us believe in transparency.
Right.
Rare exceptions.
Yeah. You have to know by the patient. I had, unfortunately, one person in the shul who, when he was the one who was sick, and then his wife wasn't feeling well, and when she went to the doctor, they found out her body was so racked with that she wasn't going to live maybe another few weeks at best. And since the husband had already had a heart attack and was in and out of the hospital, they called me up, the children called me up, they said they got together, they had a meeting, and they decided that since I was so close with the person, that I should be the one to tell him that his wife was about to die. So I called up Binyamin, I called up my son, who's a hospice chaplain, and I said, what have you been taught? Because he had to go to school for 4 years. You learn psychology and various things. And they said, not a chance. What you tell them is, you can't do that because this is in the purview of a doctor to talk to him. So only a doctor could talk to him. You tell the children that let him talk, let his doctor tell him, because if he has any questions, what are you going to say? What do you know? He has to talk to the doctor. The doctor could give him a better answer than you can. I said, absolutely right. Thank you so much. Goodbye. And when I called up the children and I told them, it's not my job. Let the doctor tell them.
What? What about
uvokat
vechaya?
What? Well, uvokat vechaya. Yeah. So do you want to live?
Leave the plug in these cases.
So you don't start to
you don't start to nothing.
You don't start. Listen, I unfortunately one of my brother-in-law, his father, when the situation began, like Sharon, literally was the same situation.
Yeah.
They thought initially that this wasn't going to be that serious. They plugged him in and kept him, and they're stuck with the plug in. And you know how long he laid there like a vegetable?
Yes,
6 years. 6 years. He died this past year. 6 years. Just under 6 years, he was like a vegetable.
But then
and the life was on hold like that.
Yeah, but doesn't play any
so role. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? They want
it.
Right.
What do you know
is
going
on? What is the pasuk? So what's the whole? You see what it is? That's the problem. We're quoting two words. What is the whole pasuk? Vokarto b'chayim leman tichyeh atov izarecho. It's not talking about that one person. It says leman tichyeh atov izarecho. Choose life. In other words, be a tzaddik is choosing life.
Is that called life to be in such a matzav?
So
no. Why do they need to plug in? Pull the plug out.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
It's a good question. No one allows to pull the plug. The question is to put the plug in to begin with.
Yeah. So be careful before you pull. Before. I was listening to one when my mother.
Indirectly pull out the plug. No, that's true. To indirectly, don't pull
with your elbow. Yeah. Knock it out.
No, to
oh, it happened.
As a person, they feel they can save a life, no?
not necessarily, that at that moment when they're putting the plug in, they feel it's just a very temporary thing, and it's a possibility he will very quickly come out of it. When they put the, many times, if they would know they would put the plug in, it would be like this for 6 years, more often than not, they would not put the plug in.
Right.
They put the plug in because we're just doing a procedure now, we got to be safe. And they put the plug in, and all of a sudden, the procedure doesn't go over. Well, they put the plug in because they had no idea it would be like this for 6 years. But now once the plug is in,
yeah, but we're still
alive for sure.
You don't know.
If Lorraine, the father is sick and hospitalized, and the surgeon, doctors, they say there is no anything we can do to make him more alive. And the father asks the kids, you should do surgery. This. It takes a lot of expenses to do. The son,
usually that's going to be... The father is not going to be, if he doesn't have medical coverage, it's going to cost him $50,000. He's not going to be that way, or he knows better. You know what I mean? It's usually that they have. He's asking a question, and the father wants surgery to save his own life, but you're talking about in the case where he doesn't have medical coverage, the operation nowadays, you know what an operation costs? Generally speaking, you're talking $50,000 right off the bat under these conditions. The hospital care is not going to be less than 50, probably way more, but at least $50,000 you're talking about. If it's something that's so life threatening, that's what it's going to cost.
Maybe
I can tell you very simply.
He has to pay.
No, but I'm just saying no because he's saying to sponsor. Are the children responsible to pay the money? That's his question.
Oh, the father is wealthy, man. Not enough.
Well, that's what he is. Right. I know, this is not what it is.
The kids should not hear him. He's not coming to Tavi Khan.
End it right there. The problem is, unfortunately, this had nothing to do with my mother, but when she was in the hospital, they came in, the lady that was in the room with her was over 90, and she was getting to the point where the children came in and they were discussing, the doctors were recommending to do this, that might help her out. And when they all left the room, the nurse came in to talk to the children and said, listen, if we hook her up, you understand the problem here. So what her suggestion was, the nurse told us, she went against what the doctors were saying and said, if she survives the next couple of days, we'll see, we're putting her on changing the medication. And if she wasn't holding any food down, she was wasting away. And she says they're going to try a new drug. If she makes it through the next 2 or 3 days, then there's always time to hook her up later to help her out. But once you hook her up, you know what the story is. You're not going to be able to undo it, and she'll end up being languishing like a vegetable, which could very well happen with her condition. But so she was, I'm just telling you what you think. Give it a couple of days and see. If she makes it through the next 2 days, you always have time to hook her up. If you hook her up now, you already are locking yourself into a scenario that you may not want.
That's right. That's
what the nurse, as opposed to the surgeons, were trying to get them to, trying to get her to say that they should go through with a procedure.
Signed over, you as the advocate.
The signing doesn't, we're talking about
a Jew. Well, obviously she didn't have, this wasn't a...
You're definitely not a Jew.
Well, what the language Reb David used, no heroic measures are necessary. Don't use... Though that's the words he used.
Why you're not going to take chemo?
Not necessarily. If the statistics are
right,
there's no chance.
Not mechuyev. Because that's exactly what happened with my father.
Not mechuyev. But people, so I'm not mechuyev. I still want to live. I want the 1% chance. That's what they ain't. And this might be this gadol. The statistics were almost zero. So he said, why should I go through this?
He said no heroic measures. If he's going to live another day, what's the point? He's just going
to
suffer.
The only reason why I want to do this is because I know that my wife, I'm going to die. And she blame herself for the rest of her life. Why didn't she insist on doing this treatment?
Right.
It could have saved me. It's total nonsense. It's not going to make one bit of a difference. But I don't want her to have that guilt. So I'm willing to suffer with this nonsense in order that she should not have this. That's what he said.
Right.
Rabbi Halacha, I'm chayev to.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right.
But Halacha doesn't say you have to pull it.
Halacha's allowed. That's so quite.
It depends who it is. Is it you or somebody else we're talking about?
No one knows if you can answer if you can pull the plug. That's totally unclear. Are you allowed to pull the plug?
If you have a bris for a grandchild the next day, so you can say, I'll pull the plug 2 days later. I mean, you know? Well, I'll plug it earlier.
Yeah, you can do that. You can do that. If you want to go to a simcha, you'll pull the plug.
There was an old story like that back in Europe.
You can do that.
There was a story where someone was geysers.
Yeah.
And he had a grandson.
Keep him alive a few more days.
No, the Shiloh was different. Let him die so that the kid will be named after his grandfather.
They can name him after.
So someone says, idiot. He's always coming for the bris already.
You're getting more and more.
He may come to Elam also.
Name him after. Nice and Nissan.
These stories don't end.
That story they said about was before this era.
Right.
Well, they didn't know from nothing. They used to come, and the halacha shalom, you have to come and check the grave. Check the grave for 3 days after you bury him. Because he might be knocking on the grave.
Bell ringer, that's how it started.
There were stories.
And who knows if that could be a lot.
There were stories.
Get me out of here. For 3 days.
It is. This comes under the category of the first week in the bungalow colony when they asked me to give the Perek class for the women. And I was preparing. I said, it's enough now. I did. My wife said, but you have so much more to do. You got only up to Perek Ches and preparing. I said, I'm not getting past Perek Ches. This is Al Tabasicha Nisha. When I walked in, there were like 25, 30 women in the bungalow lined up at the table. I said, as soon as I get to Al Tabasicha Nisha, the class is over. And so the discussion is going to be yelling and screaming and 15, 20 minutes of discussion of what it means, what it should say. It's terrible. It's this and that. And I don't have to prepare, you know, I only have to get up to Mishnah Ches for Perek Aleph.
Which Perek Aleph? It's good you were now learning to Hal Kohelis. You can come to the Pasuk.
Yeah, exactly. You know, or, you know, Isha v'chaleila lo matzasi, you know, like that. There are different psukim.
Friday said about the bell they used to have.
Yeah, the bell ringer.
The biggest problem today with hospice is that to alleviate pain, they will increase the morphine.
That's right. The hospice. Yes.
And the increase of the morphine reduces the
heartbeat.
Yeah, of course.
If you have a doctor who's not sensitive, he will say, you want your family to be comfortable? I'll give him more morphine. And the more morphine is killing
him. That's right. They don't even tell you they do.
And if you know what's going on, this is
they
what
do
you have to be aware of.
Not only in the hospital, in the hospital also.
Right. They're giving you the patient. Sometimes they're letting the patient controlling the flow. They're giving him a chance to...
There are people that hold it's not the worst of blah, blah. If the person already is comatose, so what's so terrible? You're not doing it. If this will not grumble, the hospital doing it, no one knows. No one ever came back to tell us what advantage there is in Shamayim to do this whole procedure, this whole technique. In Tanakh Chazal, this never, ever happened. Never happened. People were lying around for years, for months. The agony to the family, what it does to the family, to the living, the memories, the horror that people live with their whole life.
Right.
Yeah, but just this week, the wife of Ilan Ramon died.
Cremation. Right.
So she wants to be cremated because she doesn't want her children to go through another time. They had a brother die and their father died. So now the mother's going to die. They're going to have to go through a funeral and a matzeva.
She's at a funeral.
You don't have to have
a matzeva. You can just, but to be buried is a halacha. Ki kavartik berenu. You don't need a funeral. Doesn't say anywhere in the Torah you have to have a funeral.
The lady went up in space, whatever it is.
Not a graveside funeral.
The Israeli astronaut, his wife died.
When the person's exiting, it says the post they have to bury. The thief lives the burial. Funeral? You don't need a funeral. You don't even know what to say. Nothing. So they're in a chanami, you should give it salah, no funeral, no matzeva, no. I mean, we have to just put a marker there, and they don't have to ever come. Yes. They can bury it in an anonymous place. But the halacha, you see, are religious Jews, the Torah, the Mitzvah Daraisa, you Gevartik Berenim.
By the way, totally off the topic. I'm not wearing a tie today for a different reason. The you read yesterday's Science Times? Wearing a necktie constricts the blood flow to the brain by 15%. Yeah, right. No, but you know, you assume that that's what it is. Why? And they said it's a big problem for diabetics and certain people who have a problem. And they did that with students who took exams who were wearing a necktie at the time they took it. They achieved, they did the studies. The students who took exams, their marks, you know, if you... So before I have to start now, before I get up to speak, I'm going to loosen my tie.
They looked so,
studies
recently.
That wasn't a real study.
No control group. They did the control with people who didn't put on tefillin. Yeah, I volunteer not to put on tefillin for the next month.
No, they found tefillin is good because
what's the matter with putting on tefillin?
I remember Kevin was talking about they've done studies about the what effect it has wearing tefillin and on your blood pressure.
Yes.
On your blood pressure. If Yonis, I'm going to talk. Yonis and David. So he wears a kapot which goes all the way very tight. And he has a long beard. So one of his Talmidim, they asked him, Rebbe, why do you wear a tie?
No one sees it.
If your kapot goes all the way like this, and you keep it buttoned, and you have a long beard, and no one sees the tie, why bother? So he said to him, how do you know I'm wearing a tie?
Right. I might be. I did it for the weather. But all right. I figured it might help my blood flow so I remember more things. Contemporary poskim deal with the issue of fulfilling mitzvah bikacholim by means of the telephone. Do you have to actually be there or you could do it? So the consensus, of course, the consensus means he right away, first one that he quotes is Igris Moshe and Rav Henkin, the Minchas Yitzchak, the Chelkas Yaakov, and so on and so forth, is that while certain aspects of the mitzvah can be performed over the telephone, other aspects cannot. They rule, therefore, that when a person when a personal visit is impossible, a phone call should be made so that the mitzvah is at least partially fulfilled. So if you're doing it long range, I remember when my father-in-law was at one point in time in the hospital, so one of his cousins he showed up at the hospital one Sunday morning, totally unexpected, and he lived in London. And he came in, and we said, why are you here? He said, just to be Mavaka Chola, his cousin. He's a rich guy. But we assumed he came in for a family simcha. He said, no, when he's leaving the hospital, he's going right back to the airport. And so he flew in from London. He came in, he had the exact same name as my father-in-law, was Avram Lezer Gruskot, and he was also Avram Lezer Gruskot. He's a very well-to-do guy in London. He just got on the plane after Havdalah. He flew into New York, got back on the plane, and went back home after he went to the nursing home, and he visited him, and he went back. So, I mean, that's somebody who's going to the extreme, but he's showing you he's... very machbir about he felt close enough that that's how he was going to be Mavaka Chayla.
How do they hold a modern thing, Shiva Kola?
So of course, that's the thing. So it would be the same way. I mean, if you can't, you can't. I mean, somebody's 1,000 miles away and you're not making the trip. So you call on the phone. Obviously, you see in the homes they give out, Misaskim, they give you, all the cell phones you want. Nowadays, it's unbelievable how they think of everything. They provide you with various things so that you have... do they give you a different telephone number to use? I mean, because how do you get the... I saw people have telephones.
Kosher phones.
Maybe they want an un-kosher phone.
Doesn't have internet access.
But they want internet access.
In the case of Bikur Cholim, it says not to go early morning because they look nice. And up evening, it should
this
not
is,
go to Bikur Cholim.
Right. This is a very
phone,
interesting
maybe,
topic here, which I would have... The next thing I would have assumed that it's never allowed over here, but this is very interesting. And the question here is, may a Kohen visit a patient in a hospital? I never even thought about it because I was always under the impression that there's no chance in the world that it ever... I mean, that was my first knee-jerk reaction was, it's not possible.
A lot of hospitals today, the hospital is not a place to die today.
Right.
And they're very mocked. It destroys their statistics. Today, a hospital is not like it was 20 years ago. About 20 years ago, it's a place where... Okay,
there were many more people in the hospital, that's for sure.
Today, they push you here to help you.
Right.
You can't help
they need the bed.
Out.
I know.
You're out.
If you're not making, they can't do any more for you, they send you home.
At certain hospitals, it ruins their statistics.
So what he says over here in the answer is...
About 75% across the board. Just the number of beds.
Available.
Right.
Available.
It's not the
beds. The whole idea of
turnover.
Keeping people out of hospital, when they come in, see the bed as soon as he can.
What he mentions over here, I found interesting. It says, in Eretz Yisrael or in a hospital where the majority of the patients are Jewish, it is prohibited for a kohen to enter a hospital in order to visit a patient, unless he knows for certain that there are no Jewish corpses in the hospital. But I don't know how you could know that.
In Maimonides, they have a light outside. It's a Kohen light.
Right.
In Maimonides. Which is...
And what happens if it goes off while you're in there?
They have to leave.
I understand. I know.
But if you do not know, if you come into... I know a Kohen that was there for over a month. And they have a family of Kohanim.
Right.
And they were there very devoted, very loyal, 24-7. And they were there most of the time. They say, I asked one of the people of the family... In Maimonides, is a Kohen light outside the hospital. When you come to the outside, there's a light. If the light is off, it means as far as you're concerned, there's the people who are responsible
at
here.
The time.
There is no one here in the hospital. There's no corpse in the morgue.
My grandfather, my mother's father, who was a Kohen, he had one experience. I mean, he had said that when he was young one time, and wherever they were sleeping, I don't know if it was in yeshiva or wherever it was, one of his friends woke him up in the middle of the night and said, "Rabaya tidechum," you know, get dressed. "Rabaya tidechum." He didn't tell him why, but he understood.
It's not necessary to wake someone up.
I understand, but he said tidechum, and you know, because somebody had died, and he didn't want him to have to go out in his pajamas or whatever he had on at the time. So first he didn't want to say there's a mace, because then you got to pick yourself up and get out right away. So first he told him to get dressed. And then he said, in case you want to know why I told you to get dressed, because. So he said to him, Tidichum. So that's what my mother would always give me these, you know, it just shows, you know, she knew what she was talking about a lot of times. You grow up, and years ago, the women knew a lot more than the housewives know.
But if you go, let's say, to my mom, outside, the light is off.
Right.
There's a light outside of my mom, you know what it is? I can find out.
Well,
you go out,
you go to
the light is off.
It's only for
cars. They don't have an Apple, an emoji on your phone. Kohen light on your phone.
You're not looking to go and check every 5 minutes to go on. Once I'm in, I'm safe. If someone will come and tell me, guess what, the light's on, you got to pack out.
You see what I mean? My knee-jerk reaction would be that why put yourself in a situation where there is some sort of likelihood. You're putting yourself in a situation. Unless you're saying that I understand. Unless we're saying the mitzvah, which would go to show you that the mitzvah, picacholim, is on a higher level than we tend to attribute to it. That it's a very important mitzvah. That's my point here. That it is so important to do it, to do something for somebody else, to make them feel like you're important enough to do it.
Because he tries to avoid...
How did he get to be a surgeon? There's a problem with that.
Yeah, he has to work on kedavah. We're much more concerned about tuma than the current carbon should be l'shem of Avodah Zarah.
Right.
We murder also. They can, as long as you get... the victim, you can stab someone on the mizbeach, can fight and stab him, as long as you get him out of the Beis HaMikdash before he bleeds out. Because once he bleeds out, he's tummy mace.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, you're right.
There was no roof.
So, but here it says, outside of Eretz...
Where did he die?
So here is where we're getting to. Outside of Eretz Yisrael or in any place where the majority of patients are not Jewish, it is permitted under extenuating circumstances. It says under extenuating circumstances, such as a man visiting his wife or another close relative, or for a kohen to enter the hospital for the purpose of bikkur cholim. Obviously, if the kohen is aware that there is a Jewish corpse in the hospital, he may not enter the hospital, obviously. So that's what we're saying. Then it goes along and says what the next thing on the parsha is, Al Nosik Bereini B'Mitzrayim. It's talking about Kvuras Eretz Yisrael. Is it really necessary? Should we, you know, aspire to that? Do we do it? And there's a big discussion among people who want to get buried in Eretz Yisrael, and for a lot of people, obviously, it's causing a very big hardship in terms of expense. And he says over here, what he quotes over here is extensively, is Rab Henkin, that he said absolutely not.
Waste
the
money.
Waste the money. He says, and he was against it. What?
Clarification. Goyish corpse doesn't mean anything?
No, not the same thing.
No, I mean, if a kohen comes into hospital.
It's not the same. It doesn't have the same, you know. It
doesn't have any.
So walking past the Goyish cemetery, you know, what's the deal with a kohen? I mean, if he's alive. I know in yeshiva, when I went to Chofetz Chaim, we weren't allowed to, Rav Leibowitz was a kohen. And we weren't allowed to, if anybody who had a license and would drive away, you were drilled beforehand not to get on the Interbar. So that was the thing over there. Never go on the Interbar when you're taking him, because it was in Queens. And where he would end up going was Brooklyn. And we were always instructed never to get on the Interborough Parkway because of the cemeteries with the trees hanging over the highway.
Also, there's a
Washington
bridge. They took the bridge down.
So we had to be careful not to do that. So it says, it is commonly accepted that being buried in Eretz Yisrael is a noble aspiration. Both Yaakov Avinu and Yosef HaTzadik, who died outside of Eretz Yisrael, had this concern uppermost in their minds before their death. Consequently, many people following in the footsteps of our forefathers spend vast sums of money and spare no effort in order to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Henkin, however, rules differently. The following is a loose translation of his responsum. Concerning sending the Aron of the deceased to Eretz Yisrael, actually it is totally not to my liking, and regardless, this is said in Chovos HaLevavos, that a bonus is not given unless the debt is paid. Meaning what? For great Talmidei Chachamim who are world-renowned for their meticulous observance of mitzvos, both the easy ones and the harder ones, it is fitting and proper to bring them to burial in Eretz Yisrael, as were Yaakov and Yosef. But in this case, I tend to think that it is arrogance, merzakiyura. In addition, it is a waste of the money of middle-class widows and orphans, since it entails a tremendous expense, and the widow of orphans are sometimes embarrassed to object. I think that this could be considered stealing from the widow and the orphans. This responsum is for somebody who asks advice in this matter. However, if one wants to be buried in Eretz Yisrael, we can't stop him, because the poskim seem to allow reinterment in Eretz Yisrael as well. But the Gemara makes a big point of saying about reinterment that what you have to be careful is, Gemara's the Sanhedrin, and it talks about reinterment, is what is the problem of reinterment is the mace thinks it's the eventual, the last, the Yom HaDin, and it makes the bones shake and quake and puts undue fear into the neshama of that person.
Kabbalah, Yoni Kabbalah.
Right. And that's what the Gemara gets into and says. I remember, you know, so those are the things which, and I mentioned previously, I was asked my opinion about something that it happened in a karka where somebody went to his son's grave and he wanted to be buried. He bought the karka next to his son. His son died an unfortunate death, and he bought karka at that time for his son, who he didn't expect to need karka yet. He was in his 30s. He was killed, run over. And so he bought the plot next to his son, and when he went to visit his son, which he did almost every month, he found somebody in the grave that was going to be his, and he went and complained. And the person who sold the karka from that shul was on vacation, somebody else, and he didn't mark off that the grave was sold, didn't know, and he sold it to somebody else, and somebody was buried there. And they went to various big rabbanim, and they asked them, they said, you should leave it there. Don't ask him, but... And the people from the family refused to dig up the grave, and he didn't want to, so he was concerned, and he asked, I said, all I could say is what the Gemara says, that somebody had paid for that karka already.
Buried and stolen the grave.
And I happened to mention that. I said, that's the only thing I could say on the matter. And he told me, I didn't ask what happened. A year later, he told me that, based on what I said, they dug him up and they moved him. And I was surprised because the person, one of the people who said to leave him there was Reb Dovid. Because that was his shemesh was with, you know. He asked the right people because they're a knee-jerk reaction. But if he was going to make it, and he didn't let up. He wanted that guy out of the grave. It was a rich guy, and he wanted this was a doctor, a well-known doctor in Queens who was buried there.
Once you dig up someone, you can't bury someone in that plot.
What?
Once you dig up a plot, you can't rebury someone else in that plot.
No, but this was his... you're right. You're right. That's an interesting... The Gemara makes a point to saying that it became code to reuse a grave.
There's no reason.
Exactly.
But
that's the point.
Then what?
Only when there's no reason. You want to reuse.
If you're a person, there's no reason, so then you leave the grave, you leave it empty. But if a person was illegally buried in that spot.
That's what the Gemara deals with. The Gemara says over there, it's not a schus for the nifta. You know, there's a certain amount of things, you know, it's embarrassing, unfortunately. I remember somebody was very nispoil at his father's funeral. Somebody who was shoveling the dirt in. He was overweight, and it was June, and he was sweating profusely. He lost his balance, and as he shoveled the thing, he lost his balance, and he you were there, Mark. You don't remember, but he fell into the ground. Yankee, you might have been there too.
The whole crowd. Yeah.
But I don't know.
It happens all the time.
He fell in, and you heard the aron crack. You heard the split on the lid.
Talk to the Chavar Kaddish.
And he was saying, why me? I said to him that time.
How did he get out? That's
what I mean. They had to help him out. Let me tell you something. He didn't climb out on his own. They had to schlep him out.
You know what happens all the time? People's wild when they're shoveling, their wallets, their cell phones fall into the grave. Happens all the time.
That's why you sign that form before you do
it. The nifta has a good conversation.
That's interesting when you have later in rings, you know, after they finish mailing and you hear somebody's phone ringing in the grave. Get me out of here.
When my father was nifta, there was somebody else.
But I told this person, it's the schus for the nifta, you know, this should be his embarrassment, is... That was my knee-jerk reaction at the time. This should be his kapara. That thing, something like that happens. What? It can't be right on top. That's why on the hills it's not directly on top. It's like in Hara Menuchos. Now they opened up a new wing. They ran out of graves, but now suddenly they opened up a new wing. I'm told. You know how much the karka costs over there? I know what my sister paid. I know what my sister would pay that time, $18,000 each plot. She and her husband paid $36,000 for the two plots. Yeah, I'm sure. But, of course, this is already a little while. And the only reason they sold to them, because my brother-in-law's father is already there, so they told him that they're not selling, but your grandfather didn't. If you have a parent there, they were holding plots out. But then when his brother called, they said they have no more left. But anyhow, so that's what he said. So Rav Henke does not reveal the halakhic reason behind his ruling, but a careful analysis of the sources reveals that our sages were not unanimous in their endorsement of transporting bodies to Israel for interment. The Talmud quotes Rav Anan as saying that whoever is buried in Eretz Israel is considered as if he is buried under the altar. But the Talmud also quotes the critical view of Rav Elazar, who declares that entering Eretz Israel only after death in order to be buried there is not comparable to living and dying there. Which is what the argument is, don't send us your dead bodies, live there, and then you could, you know.
Don't come to contaminate.
Right, don't come like that. So indeed, the Rambam includes both of these views in his ruling. He says, the sages have taught that whoever resides in Eretz Yisrael, his sins will be forgiven. Whoever is buried in Eretz Yisrael would be forgiven, and it is as if his burial plot is an altar. But entering Eretz Yisrael after death is not comparable to entering Eretz Yisrael during one's lifetime. Nevertheless, the greatest rabbi had their dead buried there. Go and learn from Yaakov Avinu and Yosef HaTzadik. But they did live in Eretz Yisrael at a certain point in time in their life. And, you know, this is not one of the things you can answer before Matan Torah, certainly. But the idea is that, listen, we learn from this and we learn from these things. It's just showing the chavivas. The one thing that I didn't realize was, I mean, I had my own gematria as a kid, but then I was told this is the Balaturim. You see that if you take Avraham and Yaakov together, it equals 430. Together, Yitzchak, it's not part of the equation because he didn't live in Chutz Laaretz. So Bnei Yisrael, Avraham and Yaakov lived in Chutz Laaretz, and their names together total 430, which is Arba, you know, 430 years that they were in. It says Shloshim Shana V'Arba Me'el Shana. That's how long the Golus was, and which I mentioned another gematria with that, the 430 with Ohi Sotel Olam, but. It says, the Rambam, albeit hesitantly, seems to endorse the practice. The Zohar, however, says that those who live outside of Eretz Yisrael, yet have their bodies brought to Eretz Yisrael for burial, are considered to be contaminating Eretz Yisrael. According to the Zohar, then, it would be undesirable to bring a corpse into Eretz Yisrael. Seemingly, there are various somewhat conflicting views among our sages on the subject. And it goes on and on and on, but anyhow, the last thing it says over here, it should be made clear, however, that by no means is this a view of all poskim. One should consult his own Rav, who is familiar with his personal situation, before making an important decision such as this. Okay, so
we said that 430,
yeah.
But Redu is
210.
210.
Right.
And this end of this.
There's process, a lot of words that are 210.
Pakod, if code. Pakod is 190.
Yeah.
If code is going to decrease from the time of Galut.
Yeah, there's a lot of things. The word, what do you call it? There are a lot of words that have.
But what is happening that Hashem decreed to be 430?
Vayugad, my own is Vayugad l'melech v'shayin ki barach ha'om. Barach is 210. Paro sent them out. He chased them out and didn't expect them to come back. But somebody whispered in his ear that it was the survey. So he gave up, really. But Vayugad l'melech, what was he told? That they were supposed to be there 400 years. And now it was only up to 210. So now he was he had hope at this point that he could make them come back. Barbanel says totally something very different. He says that since the whole idea was to get the Mitzrayim to the Yam was just with blinders on. Didn't they see where they were going? They're crazy after the 10 Makas, they're riding into the Yam. So they just had the rise to kill. All they wanted to do at this point was they had no intention of bringing Bnei Israel back this point, to take them back to Mitzrayim to re-enslave them, that when he came after them. He just wanted to kill them all at this point. That was their only intention, was to just kill all the Jews.
In order to and that's all. The Mincha.
And that so blinded them, they didn't even look where they were going. They didn't see they were going into the Yamsuf, that this could happen. They walk up and see a wall of water after the 10 Makos. They didn't think, this is a bad idea. Look what we're doing over here. We're putting our lives in jeopardy riding into the Yam. But they were so blinded by their hatred for the Jews, they weren't looking where they were going. And they just went headlong into the Yam, and of course what happened.
And the point is that Yaakov told Ikafsu, Yosfu, Agidur Hashem, Tashir, Kiro Hashem, Be'acharit HaYomim. And he saw that in the Shevatim there is no Chet and Tet. Chet. And also there is no Kuf and Sadi. Ket. In the Reuben Shimon, there is no Kuf, okay. Sadi. Therefore, He couldn't tell them the...
Anybody have anything to add until Mincha?
Mincha's 16.
Yeah, I know. I know what time it is.
We should get someone from the Hebrew Kaddish.
Yeah.
So say you have some stories from Israel.
Some guy, my father.
Okay, I'll get that story. I was at the Beit Shemesh Cemetery, and I look at the Kvarim, and I see one cave, the name of the family is Baal. I said, what kind of family has the name of Baal? Then I see the next cave next to it has the name Balshovsky. The guy was...
He shortened his name.
His name was Balshovsky, and the kids changed the name to Baal. So I met a family, and they said their name, they have a big yichus in Yerushalayim, their name is Bruchi. I said, there's no Bruchi. So I do a Google. I find that in September 26, 1926, a guy by the name of Pinchas Schlesinger got permission to change his name to Pinchas Bruchi. Schlesinger is a very old Yerushalmi family.
It's a lot of names.
Why did he pick Bruchi? It seems that in the early 1800s, we had a Zayde, his name was Baruch Leib Schlesinger. And for some reason, every child of Baruch Leib was Moshe Baruch Schlesinger, Ava Baruch Schlesinger.
They are going to bury the people in two floors.
When he made the tree, their grandfather's name was Pinchas Baruchi. So they said, his father was also
Yeah, you don't know. It just shows you when my parents were in the army. My mother wasn't in the army, but she was with my father when they were overseas. So my mother got a job while my father was a soldier. She got a job in Portland, and she was a bookkeeper. She answered the ad for a guy that was named Lou Wing. She thought she was going to go see a Chinaman. She got to the office. It was a little eagle. His name was Liza Fliegel. He Americanized it to Lou Wing.
Okay, anyone want to say Kaddish? We also have to get Baal and Bekaidu. Hey, Baal and Bekaidu.
Baal and Amila. Baal and Bekaidu.
Yeah, but they ship you over.
Before they buy
we're going down. We're
going to
be right back.
Finally, he woke up.
There is Mincha. Look, I'm not leaving.
But do you know what they do today?
This is not a minion?
If they're going down, they should be a minion, not now.
This week is the last.
It's too later.
Tomorrow's the last minute.
November.
You know,
we like that?
No, but sure. 10:30.
10:30.
I know what you're saying.
Instead of 20 to 10, make it 5 to 10.
So she says what she does.
Then he's sure you can't do that either. You have been for a certain, you know, shop is a certain time. You can't do it. You can't. And what would happen? If you wait for
the week anyway. The truth of the matter is that but first of all, land, you can get a whole afternoon in it. And I got 1:45.
What happened yesterday? I gotta get out 12 o'clock. I'm waiting for the bus. The bus doesn't come. The bus doesn't come.
I was going over yesterday as half told.
Yeah.
How so recent. The castrate. We had so many castrates on it. I don't understand why everything's that up.
Why who does bring it up?
Nobody writes about Hasarisa.
Those were the lines. You know why somebody they made Sarisa?
You can meet my father's stone.
The English word for it is a eunuch.
They didn't want the people who were in service to the king.
Once a person
they didn't want them to have any outside interest. So he was 24/7, had to be at the beck and call. If he had a wife and family, he would not be able to service the king. He would have to, his mind would be on other things. No, but we didn't do it. So we don't know if that's what they did. The Jewish people, they certainly wouldn't, but these weren't necessarily Jewish people.
So why are we concerned?
But that's what we call, that was the purpose of it.
Eurics.
And now we remind you. I had a friend of mine who was interviewed for a job in the Talmud Torah. So we had to meet with the board. He said, yes. He says, can I see them? He says, no. He says, why not? Because next year he'll ask me if I'm circumcised.
My father had one of the women on open school night said to him, he was a important yeshiva with a lot of trouble at all. She says, listen, Rabbi. My father came home laughing, but not laughing. A bit that he got laughing. Listen, I understand why he hosted me, but I don't believe it.
There's going to be a big problem. Arnold was taking him off the hash. That's going to be big problems for the towns outside of Israel. Like when I go to Florida, right away, I used to go to Arnold. You know,
going back to like 1969, 1970, my parents came back. They were with their friends. They would go in the summer. They were both teachers, so they, you know, summertime, they took vacations. They would travel, and they were just in a store, a grocery store, upstate New York. And my father went and found something near with Ashkoka. In those days, he didn't have that many Ashkoka. And he said to the person at the counter, do you have any other food with this symbol on it? He said, why, what does that mean? The person said, this is the means that the food is kosher, so, you know, we can buy it. The guy looked at his wife and said, he told me that story when he came back. Upstate New York. Way upstate New York. They probably went to Canada.
Canada
sure you, that's the one thing you can't find is bread. Somebody told me not long ago that when we were going, says, make sure, oh yeah, when we went to the Canadian Rockies, make sure you buy, take a loaf of bread with you. Because you will find cake with Ashkocha in Canada, you will find no bread with Ashkocha in Canada. And he was right. In Montreal, you get some places, but out west, you're going to get. And that's the first time in my life I wore a hat. I bought like I looked terrible in those days in the baseball cap. Now my face got thinner and it looks bad. So I bought like a cowboy hat, you know, to walk around. I wear my yarmulke every place in my life. Hey, somebody once said, you can't wear yarmulke. I said, if I can't wear my yarmulke, I don't go. So that's the end of that story. In the Western Canada, there, you know, I mean, they're really even in Montreal area. Very anti-Jewish. You can't get bread with Ashkocha, and it's very anti-Jewish. So anti-Jewish. Oh, terrible, terrible. And if you don't speak French, they don't like you either.
My wife, my wife.
Montreal, if you don't speak French,
why your wife's so lucky?
You know what I left at? We went on tour of the Royal Museum of Montreal. So we were walking around, and all the signs were in French and in English. They were French. They know this is not a long time ago. We were doing, my brother in law had a shtel in
Everything
was money, French and English, French. Except for one sign that I saw suddenly, white language. I took French for 3 years in high school, and I could read French very, very decently. And so I look at the sign and said, "What do you mean?" I said, "You know what that sign says? In case of fire, use this door only." I said, "They didn't have that in English. If you can't read French, so pas bread inside." I said, "That was it. Use this exit." It was only a
letter. You didn't know what a cherry was. Lettuce was perfect English.
I remember we once went there about 15
years ago.
We have a minion here, but we have the system right now. Mark didn't come up yet. I don't know, it probably is nice that I was waiting online.
Let's say they go fire drill. They have to go. I can first put the fire drill for the general.
Amen.
prices, but some of the ones, the one that